Allobiont explores how organisms in the living world are really superorganisms, formed by a host and all of its communities of microorganisms. To explore these interactions in sickness and in health, I interview researchers at the crossroads of microbiology, evolution, immunology, computational biology, and beyond. Okay, so hey, do you want to start by just introducing yourself, maybe telling us a bit about, you know, your training and your research right now?
Yeah, so I'm Louie. I am a second year PhD student at Oxford. My program is called Interdisciplinary Bioscience, but basically my PhD is in virology. I did my undergraduate also at Oxford. I did biomedical sciences and I specialized in infection and immunity. I guess that was my major. And then my minor was in molecular medicine. So kind of had an immunology infectious disease sort of background, and then, but also had a bit of kind of molecular methods. So I went into my program, which had a rotation year at the start. Obviously everything was a bit disrupted by COVID, but I've ended up in the Costello lab, who are interested in RNA binding proteins and viral infection. So it's a really nice kind of mix of virology and for me innate immunity, and then a bit more of kind of actually some really interesting kind of novel methods and high throughput approaches. So that's kind of how I got to where I am, I guess.
And so what are the viruses you work on as model systems mostly?
It's a good question. In the lab, we work on all sorts of viruses. I think the nice thing about the Costello lab is that there's not like one particular virus that we're wedded to, because it's more about host virus interactions than about specific viruses and their mechanisms. So we're really interested in like how host proteins are interacting with viral RNA or are changing their interactions in response to infection. So there are a bunch of people who work on HIV. There are people who work on SYNBIS virus. I don't exactly know what I'll end up probably doing the bulk of my stuff on, but SYNBIS is a good model virus. It's related to chikungunya, and it's nice because you can work with it in cat too. So you kind of get the nice aspects of being able to actually do some virology, but you have so many fewer restrictions than if you're working with HIV, for example. So for us, where we're less interested in kind of direct clinical applications and more interested in kind of basic mechanisms, it's a really handy virus. And also, obviously, in the last year, as all labs, not just virology labs, have started working on SARS-CoV-2. So there are also some projects at the moment that are looking at that. I think part of like, you know, what the Costello lab does is looking across viruses to try and find conserved mechanisms or pathways. So actually for that, it's kind of better not to be wedded to just one virus.
Like, what's the typical day in the lab for you? And now that you're moved more to, you know, computational stuff, like what's the kind of raw data that you work with?
It's hard for me to know because my PhD has been slightly atypical, as with most people. Mm-hmm. The main kind of lab method that I'm using at the moment is called RNA interactome capture, which is where you essentially try and identify all of the proteins that are interacting with RNA in the cell. So I've been looking at how the interferon response changes the patterns of proteins that are binding to RNA. A kind of typical day in, you know, a lab like the Costello lab is you probably have some tissue culture, so you need to keep your cells alive, and usually you'll need to kind of check up on or feed your cells every day or every other day. And I really love tissue culture. I think it's a really nice kind of ritual and like part of biology, you kind of get to like a little Tamagotchi or something, you need to keep yourselves alive. So yeah, that's always like a kind of nice part, apart from at the moment when tissue culture is super busy. And then, you know, it's a lot, I've been kind of working on these more like big experiments that take a bit longer to do, and then you have to wait for the proteomic results, and then you kind of are doing a bunch of analysis. So it's like sample prep, a lot of Western blots, a lot of kind of silver staining, so like methods that allow you to look for the proteins you're interested in. And the RNA interactome capture method is essentially where you have these beads that allow you to like pull the RNA out of the sample, and you cross-link proteins to the RNA prior to doing that, so that if you pull down the RNA, you'll pull down any protein bound to it. So doing those kind of approaches. In terms of the computational side of things, I'm kind of working on, there's an amazing database called ENCODE, which has like an incredible wealth of data that's being put there. It's an amazing resource, and part of like a set of data sets that they have are ECLIP data sets. And ECLIP is a method that allows you to identify where on RNA proteins are binding, so you can identify the specific binding sites. So kind of originally when lockdown started, my project was kind of to use this ECLIP data to, I guess, mine it and kind of see what we could determine about where the proteins were binding, like what that could kind of tell us about what these proteins were. So that's kind of something that's evolved a bit and that I've continued to work on. And we're kind of interested in seeing if we can use the ECLIP data to perhaps make predictions about where proteins are binding in viral RNA, which is obviously nice because an ECLIP experiment is extremely expensive and takes a very long time. So it's kind of useful if you have a computational approach that can roughly approximate where you might expect binding to be. So you don't have to do the ECLIP experiment always in infected cells. So that's kind of on that side of thing. I work on R, you know, most days you'll spend all day working on something and then you just chuck it out at the end of the day because it doesn't work, or because it works but it's not what you want it to be. So it's like very much trial and error and quite frustrating, especially when you're starting out. But it's definitely been like a great learning experience for me, because I went from like no experience to now kind of spending a lot of my time sort of on my computer. And then, you know, the other aspect of computational work is obviously analyzing these big omics data sets. So, you know, you get a proteomics data set, and you could probably spend a whole year just like mining that data set. Like, they're so rich in information, and that's why they're really cool. So at the moment I'm kind of in the stage where I'm still generating my data, and then I'm hoping once I have my data sets, then I can kind of have a bit of fun with them. So just kind of getting my head around those types of analyses at the moment, so that I'm ready when everything opens up and we can get the proteomics done.
And what kind of like classification or output do you get with your proteomics data? Because let's say, for example, when we're looking even at a basic like a gene expression, then you like use gene ontology to qualify them into like categories of cellular functions. Do you do some similar things with your proteomics, or what are you trying to make it, the data say, basically?
I think you can do a lot of similar things with proteomics as you can do with transcriptomics. So again, yeah, you can use gene ontology to look for enrichment of specific like categories of genes. I think what we're interested in is kind of differential RNA binding. So you see what proteins are binding in one condition and aren't binding in another, or what proteins are binding to the viral RNA specifically. So it's really just a discovery tool more than anything else. Like, you want to see what proteins are there and you want to be able to classify them so that you can say, okay, this is weird. We see loads of proteins involved in DNA damage repair, for example. And that's kind of strange because why would we see those bound to cytoplasmic RNA viruses? And then you can say, okay, that's really interesting. Now we're going to use this kind of large unbiased data set, which is what's really nice about proteomics, is that you have no idea what you're going to find. You might have some idea, but there are obviously biases in everything we do, but you're not kind of pre-selecting what you're hoping to see. So then really, I think you just let the data lead you, and you can intersect it with all different types of data sets and, you know, proteins that we already know are involved in viral infections, proteins that we already know are bound to RNA, and kind of use all of, you know, bring all that information together and identify proteins that are of interest. And then the kind of just as important as the proteomics is the follow-up studies. So then you need to be able to, you know, do the functional assays to identify whether the protein is actually important in viral infection. You know, what the phenotype is it proviral or antiviral? Like, does the virus grow just as well if it's there or not? And is it conserved across different viruses? So in the lab, we have a plate reader, which allows you to measure fluorescence on a plate, which is kept under like the correct conditions for cell growth, which means you can actually like measure fluorescence using like fluorescent viruses and see how like the kind of infection, the course of infection is altered using different cell lines. So, you know, you take a knockout cell line of your gene of interest, and then you can see how does this change the dynamics of viral replication, like compared to just a normal cell line. Do we see that the virus is growing more slowly? Is it not growing at all? Or is it, you know, actually replicating much more efficiently? So it's kind of a discovery tool, which you then can use for diving deeper into specific proteins, but you're not necessarily going in with your favorite protein and being like, okay, I want to see how highly expressed this protein is or whatever.
Mm-hmm. And are all the cell lines like mammalian cell lines, or do you also look at like bacteriophages?
Yeah, we don't look at that, but I mean, you know, there's so many fascinating things, and I'm sure that's like another fascinating area. But no, we just focus on mammalian cell lines. You know, I think there are people who are specialists in phages and specialists in like bacterial work, and that's just yeah, I guess not what we do so much. But I mean, phages are amazing, so I'm sure that would be really interesting. Although, yeah, obviously they're DNA, so, but you know, all viruses have to have RNA as well. So even DNA viruses will have RNA and will have these interactions.
And in your previous rotation, you were working on like the genome, like the structure of the genomes of RNA viruses, right?
Yeah.
Can we talk about like a bit more about what you did last year and what were the main findings, if there were any?
Well, I was trying to optimize a method, which didn't work. So sadly, no results. I mean, it's quite an interesting area. So coronaviruses, which obviously SARS-CoV-2 is one of, have highly structured genomes. So RNA, unlike DNA, is like a single-stranded molecule, and it can bind to itself, so it can form like loops and different structures. So when you have these structures, like often in viral genomes, they can serve important roles in the cell. Because viruses, particularly RNA viruses, are quite constrained in like what they can do. They have really limited coding capacity, which means they can't have like huge genomes with loads of proteins that can do all of the things they need to do. Often they'll repurpose structures to serve the roles that proteins might serve in our cells. So they actually have important like regulatory roles. They're important in terms of like regulation of transcription, translation, replication, things like that. But then interestingly, some viruses like coronaviruses have this more like generalized secondary structure throughout their genomes. And it's really not clear at all like what that secondary structure is doing. It's just clear that viruses that persist in their natural host have this feature. So, you know, it's an interesting kind of question of what does this mean about SARS-CoV-2 in terms of its ability to persist? We know that coronaviruses and a lot of other hosts do develop persistent infections, which is quite unusual for an RNA virus. But you know, the ones that do develop persistent infections, like HCV, also hepatitis C virus, also have the same kind of genome structure. So it's really kind of working out, okay, what is it about the structure that is allowing the virus to kind of persist in the cell? That's like, either, you know, I'm kind of interested in innate immunity. Like, is it that there's innate immune pathways that aren't being activated because of the structure? Like, what, you know, there are interesting examples of where secondary structures can kind of be used to, I guess, kind of fool the innate immune response. So yeah, that was kind of the idea. But I think with COVID and everything, I've had to kind of pivot my project a bit away from lab work. I'm still doing lab work, but like towards more computational methods. So yeah, that's what I've been more focused on for, I did a bit straight after COVID started. I kind of had to learn R very quickly to actually have something to do. And then also since then, I've been working on it a bit more as well.
But so, I mean, how stable are these secondary structures? And if they're short-lived, how do you detect them? How can you visualize them? And as you say, some of your work is now computational. So can you predict them on the basis of sequence alone? Or do you have to actually, you know, observe them?
Yeah, that's a good question. So there are in vitro and in silico methods. So essentially, if you want to, you can feed any RNA sequence into a like structure prediction tool, and it will just say, okay, so there's a G here and a C here, and those two combine to each other. Obviously, like, that doesn't mean very much when it comes down to it. But what you can then do is basically kind of come up with an optimal structure. Like, energetically, there's one conformation which will kind of be optimal over others. So then you can use that to say, okay, this would seem to be what the structure is. But then it becomes complicated, because you can do that for literally any sequence you want, but there are so many other factors in the cell that will influence whether that secondary structure is forming or not. So in an ideal world, obviously you want to actually be able to, you know, visualize the RNA or have some experimental method. So there's a method called SHAPE, which is an experimental method that allows you to kind of identify where there are secondary structure features. But again, you know, as you say, like, they are transitory. You know, everything in a cell is kind of random in a sense, and it's just whether it's, you know, kind of more shifted towards structure or more shifted away from structure. So there are some structures which are really clear and will kind of always be there, but then a lot of the time they won't. And actually, it's maybe those differences in structure that are interesting. But yeah, it is something that's, I think, quite difficult to get a firm handle on. And so in the Simmons group, which is where I was doing my rotation, they're quite interested in also how you do kind of, you come up with like conservation metrics for secondary structure. So, you know, you also want to look at, are the structures conserved over different viral RNAs, like over different, you know, strains of SARS-CoV-2, or, and then based on that, you can say, okay, well, we seem to be seeing the same structure across all of these different viruses, so it's probably likely to be important, like it hasn't been selected out, which is, you know, what you would expect if it was just random. You wouldn't see it conserved. So then that's kind of another important thing. So you're not looking just in the cell or in a specific virus, but also across different strains, you know, different viruses within the same family, which can give you an idea.
At what stages of the reproduction cycle of the virus is RNA structure particularly important in? Is it mostly just avoiding detection by like the pattern recognition receptors, or is it also other steps?
So it's probably important for every step. I don't think there's necessarily one step, but there are specific structures that we know are important for specific things. Viruses like hepatitis C virus and a bunch of other viruses that have these things called internal ribosomal entry sites, which are secondary structures that can engage the ribosome and basically mean that the viral RNA doesn't have to have the machinery that's usually required for translation initiation, which is really important because a lot of viruses actually shut off host translation so that there's more kind of space for their own RNA to be translated, and also so that the cell isn't able to produce antiviral factors. So it kind of has a clever workaround where it says, okay, we're gonna basically degrade all the proteins that you need to translate your proteins, but we can still translate ours because we've got this kind of funky RNA structure, which allows the ribosome to bind. I think they're involved in a lot of things. And I think it's one of those things where like we really don't know the full scope of how much they're involved in. And, you know, what we're really interested in the Costello lab is to do with where proteins are binding, and secondary structure is likely to be quite important. And, you know, it's kind of been seen in certain cases, probably secondary structure is important in determining which proteins can bind where. And also just general protein functionality. There's also a really interesting example of flaviviruses produce a subgenomic RNA, again, kind of like coronaviruses, which is produced because of secondary structure, but essentially there's an enzyme which degrades RNA, and there's a secondary structure that's like basically like a tangle in your hair or something, like it's really hard to get through. So the enzyme can't actually get to degrade, or it's like limited in its degradation, which then produces this kind of shorter RNA product. Which it then would seem, I mean, I think that, you know, there's still a lot that's not known about it, but actually can kind of bind up a lot of proteins that would otherwise potentially be antiviral, kind of like mop them up or change their functionality or their localization in some way. That's kind of a way to, and again, like maybe influence what's happening in the cell. There's a lot. It's like, the thing with viral RNA is that it's so so packed with information on like every level. Like it's not just the sequence that has to code for multiple different genes and also has to, you know, be able to evade an innate immune response, but also you have these structures which are then also encoding information. The structures can also be kind of problematic for the virus because often they can also be what's recognized by the innate immune system. There are certain structures of there are certain structures which actually activate innate immune mediators. So it can kind of go both ways, and that's true of like pretty much everything in virology, which is why it's cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because concerning interactions with host proteins, I mean, the cytosol is packed with our own cellular RNA. So what's the main basis of differential recognition between ours and viral RNA?
So it depends on the protein. So there are a few different ones. Probably like kind of the most well-researched are the RIG-I-like receptors. So you've got RIG-I and MDA5 or something. So RIG-I recognizes 5' triphosphate groups. I think MDA5 recognizes kind of the length of the RNA. This is not my area of expertise. So I'm just kind of going back to undergraduate stuff here. But so there are these specific kind of structures or features that can be recognized that you don't see in host RNAs. Another interesting one is ZAP, which binds to, it would appear, CpG dinucleotides, so a C followed by a G. Cellular RNAs are really depleted in CpGs. So then if a CpG high sequence enters the cell, then that's kind of a trigger that's probably not meant to be there. So a lot of viruses also have suppressed CpG in order to evade ZAP. So there was a paper that came out that showed like in HIV, basically, if you add back in the CpGs, or if you add in CpGs, you know, you increase that binding and then you increase recognition. I'm sure there are others that I can't think of right now, and I'm sure there are others that we don't know about. It's a really interesting question of how you differentiate between host RNA and viral RNA. And often, you know, it's probably also context dependent. So I seem to remember that like I think RNase L, which is activated by the innate immune response, will degrade host RNAs so that they start to look like viral RNAs. So once you've already had activation of the innate immune response, essentially you kind of like lower the barrier for activation further so that then you can kind of basically amplify the response in the cell. So yeah, I think actually once the immune response has kind of started, there does become a slightly blurry line, which is what helps to amplify that response. But yeah, I think it's why for me, like viral innate immunity is so interesting because there is actually so little to differentiate the host from the virus in terms of like, you know, what the cell can see.
Yeah, but I mean about those, you know, dinucleotide patterns, it's so interesting because do you find that, does it correlate more or less with viral fitness? Like the less it has, the better off it is?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I'm, again, not an expert in this, but yeah, I think if you add in CpGs, you have a decrease in viral fitness. But at the same time, there are some viruses that don't suppress CpG, like they just don't bother. And in those cases, it's probably that they found another workaround. So, you know, they don't suppress CpG, but maybe they have a protein that degrades ZAP, or, you know, they found some other way to get around this particular feature of the innate immune response. So that's, you know, in virology, like you see a lot of different solutions to the same problem. So there's, yeah, I don't think CpG dinucleotide suppression is like the only way. It just seems like I think it's a way that works quite well, which is why a lot of viruses do it. But yeah, it's definitely, but yeah, if you were to add them back into a virus that hadn't evolved these other features, then you would see that it would have reduced fitness.
Right. So, I mean, potentially that could have applications for viral vectors, I guess, either for vaccine design or for gene therapy. Like if you kind of saturate their genome with CpGs, then would it be able to revert? Like, I guess maybe a safer approach would be, you know, just delete a whole gene necessary for replication, but I guess it could be interesting to see if it would be enough, you know, to be fit enough to deliver, but then obviously to stop there and then when its job is done.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting idea. I think there are people who are doing things like that. I haven't read much about it, but yeah, I know, you know, that I think it's a really interesting area of research of like how do you make viruses that are attenuated enough but not attenuated completely. And I think what's cool about that is that it requires you to have a really kind of deep understanding, not just of the virus, but also of how the host cell interacts with it, because really what you're taking advantage of there is how the host cell is responding to that virus rather than the virus itself. Because, you know, if you didn't have ZAP in that cell, then the virus would be just as fit. There's no reason that it would have reduced fitness just because it has more CpGs. But, you know, that's why, you know, viruses are amazing, is because it's not just about the virus. It's so much about how it's interacting with the cell. Like, it's just, you literally can't have what, like, viruses without their host cells. Yeah, it's these really interesting and difficult problems because you need quite a deep understanding of, like, you know, the cell biology as well as the virology to be able to, like, you know, engineer those kinds of things, because obviously, you know, it's so incredibly complex. And our immune systems have been evolving for, you know, hundreds of thousands of years to be what they are now. But yeah, I know. So yeah, it's really cool. And yeah, I think that's like an interesting avenue and an interesting kind of more clinical application. I feel like I'm kind of interested just in what's happening and not really like how you can apply it. Obviously, it would be cool. But yeah, it's nice to have those because then you can kind of justify it to other people.
Yeah, great. And then maybe what recent papers have you read about, you know, virus evolution and host RNA virus interactions that you're most interested in or most interested to get to see the follow-up research about?
That's a good question. I feel like I'm back in a PhD interview. Oh God, what good papers have I read recently? I've been working on a review recently, so I've been reading a lot of papers which are more about kind of the proteins interacting with viral genomes. Specifically like what's bound to the viral genome. Doing that research has got me really excited about like what we're gonna see going forward about kind of in relation to that, because we have these really interesting data sets, but I think there's like so much more to them than has like been sort of done already. And I think there's a lot of scope for like pushing them further. So instead of just looking under normal conditions, like looking, you know, I'm interested in like the interferon response, how that's changing it, you know, thinking about how potentially like different types of cells respond differently or changing the balance of proteins bound. I think my reading's been a bit blinkered by that at the moment, and just like focusing on that. But there's so much cool stuff. And I think, you know, this past year has obviously been really interesting looking at all the research coming out about SARS-CoV-2. And it's been amazing to see, as a student, how this process happens. Because, you know, you read about the original SARS outbreak, or you read about these kind of pandemics of the past or outbreaks of the past, and it feels quite we looking back have a complete set of literature basically that's given to us of like, okay, so this is what we found about this virus. But I think what's been cool is you know, it's been cool to see how the literature's evolved as the pandemic has evolved, you know, like how we've seen people's ideas change and our understanding of the virus improve over time. And I think it's just been a cool experience of how science is, you know, has to happen in like this real-time way, because often that is kind of more hidden. Like science is not very dynamic because of the time that it takes the stuff to get published. So I think like, you know, seeing how people have had to work things out like on a global scale in real time, I think has mm-hmm. has been really interesting. And seeing, you know, the papers that have come out of that, obviously, some of better quality than others, which is understandable. But
it's like now you have a preprint, it's fine. Like it's as if your article were peer reviewed and everything.
Yeah, I mean, definitely to the media it is. It's an interesting time to kind of just be watching what's happening in science. And I think it will be interesting also to see what happens, you know, things die down a bit, seeing if things kind of go back to how they were before, or if we have more of like a culture of preprints, or I don't know. It's been interesting.
Yeah, and then maybe our research, which makes sense, is hugely biased towards pathogenic viruses. But do you see examples in your work where the activity of viruses is actually beneficial to the host?
Mm-hmm. There are definitely examples, mm-hmm. not ones that I specifically focus on. My favorite example, which you've probably heard before, is that the gene that allows us to form a placenta, so that allows mammals to exist, is actually a viral gene that allows viruses to form syncytia between cells, which is how some viruses spread. So yeah, I love that example. I think it's not something that we really focus on, and I think it's something that's quite hard to study. I find the idea that we have viruses that have very closely evolved with us over a very long time, things like cytomegalovirus and Epstein-Barr virus, where, I mean, less now, but in like, you know, before kind of the rise of, you know, hygiene and everything, like everyone had these viruses. And I find it kind of fascinating to think, like, what does that mean for how our immune systems have evolved? The fact that basically they've always evolved with these viruses in tow. And I mean, you know, I think recently we have found like new viruses that we didn't even know existed, that are just kind of in our bodies. And I think, you know, in that way, it's maybe part of what we think of as just our cell biology or like our physiology is in part shaped evolutionarily or in individuals by our interactions with viruses. But I don't know, I think, you know, it's just one of the, again, like, people aren't super interested in how they're good, because that's not really how you get grants. Like, you want to get a grant so that you can say, oh, we're going to find an antiviral drug, instead of being like, oh, great news, guys, actually, this virus is good. But it's like, okay, what can we do with that? I mean, I think also, you know, what's been interesting and what will continue to be cool is thinking about how we can use phages. And I think phages probably are important for our biology as well, in terms of how they interact with our microbiome, because they are probably a really influential shaping factor in that. And I think it'll be interesting to see how we can make use of that. But also interesting to just think about how it might be already happening inside us without us even realizing.
I mean, proceed. That's the line of research I'm the most passionate about, like how viruses are beneficial. And you were saying EBV and CMV. I think that there's a researcher that said that, you know, herpes viruses have been studying us far longer than we've been studying them.
Yeah.
In that they're also with us even before we were humans and even before we were anything close to primates. And it's just, yeah, I mean, I think they've been with us for like 180 million years.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. Like, we can learn so much about ourselves from studying viruses. And I mean, even, you know, we look in our genomes and we find the remnants of like so many viruses that have infected us in the past. Mm-hmm. And yeah, we can learn about virus evolution from that, but it's also just, yeah, it's just, yeah, I mean, I think it's amazing. And so cool that we kind of have this insight through viruses into kind of how our cells are working, because they are pretty amazing.
maybe we can finish off by just, if anyone's interested in your research and what you're doing right now, where should they go to find out more?
So probably the Costello Lab website is the place to go. Good website, and you can find like the papers and stuff there, you know, just to say, there's so many amazing papers out there and so many amazing researchers. So really lucky. It's a really amazing time to be doing this.
Right, well, thank you so much.
Yeah, no, it's my pleasure.